taking the time to come and think about and hopefully share some of your own experiences about near-death experiences and or near-death awareness. I'll kind of describe and go through and describe some of those. First, I got to introduce myself. I'm Mark Papke Larson. I work as a chaplain. Been working for as a chaplain in acute care setting, hospital setting, for 15 years, and also at the same time as a hospice chaplain. And what I'm going to share with you, I really do out of the deepest sense of respect. What I'm sharing with you are the stories that people have told me and those my colleagues, and along the way. And many, many of these stories I've asked directly for permission. Some I can't ask directly for permission. And those, of course, I changed those enough so that they wouldn't be recognizable. But in the telling of the story, what I found over the years, what they learned from grief, working with people who are grieving, is that you honor the person who you tell the story about. It's a respectful story, you honor them. Almost overwhelmingly, people will say, I don't know what, you know, I was in line, I shook their hands, then afterwards I met them and I didn't know what to say to them. Well, let me tell you, tell them a story about the person they love. You know, if it fits, if you know, tell them a little bit something. I remember when your uncle, that's one of the, we honor people when we do that. In fact, that's what the gospel is, isn't it? I mean, that's what the gospel is. It is an honoring of the story of the life and the death of Jesus. About Jesus, you know, his experience coming to face his what I would call near-death awareness, his awareness that his own death was coming, and his experience of his dying, and having in the midst of that experience of his dying, things that are not easily explainable. So the other thing, as we kind of start, is when I first started in chaplaincy, I had got a good education, good high school, good college education, had a good, very good seminary education, and when I went into the parish, these stories I heard skeptically. I heard them skeptically when I first started to hear them. I wondered, well, you know, there's a Gary Larson cartoon, you know, Gary Larson is a hospital, so. There's the surgeon and the doctor's nursing working over this patient's hospital bed, and one of the surgeon's heads in the cartoon is popped up, and he says, quick, bring the light, bring the flashlight, quick.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I got to admit, that skepticism was a part of me. Now, it wasn't a part of me because I'm a skeptical by nature. It's part of me because it's culturally, we're skeptical about those things. How do you measure them, taste them? It's hard to do that. So I ask, as you kind of approach this, to hold that skepticism and honor it in a way. It's there. It's raising us to ask questions. We need to be able to ask those questions and find our way through them. Because when you do, when you hear these stories, they are moving and they are inspiring and they will help you better understand your own life and, when it comes to it, your own dying process. So I want to start, it's a long way for you guys. That's okay. And I also want to say that, you know, one of the things you should do whenever you give a talk is you should fill the audience, at least about half of them, with your own family and friends. I'm thinking of the positive thing. I don't know if they're going to do that. What study? Thanks, Carol. I want to, when you read about this and you come here, if you feel comfortable sharing, what are some of the questions that came to your mind? Are there things that you want to have answered before you leave right off the top? We won't necessarily answer them, but to get those questions from the Lord, I don't like it when I go somewhere and I've got a question, and then I leave and I say, I never asked them. No. Is there anything else? Ideas, thoughts, questions that kind of pop in your mind?
I have a question.
Hmm?
Sure. The fear that people experience before death.
The fear?
Yeah.
And are you, what's the context? Kind of, are you thinking about a specific story
I have conversations with hospice people in the past, and to be able to identify the fact that people oftentimes are fearful before.
Fearful before death, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Talk about, we'll definitely talk about fear and death and how those, and what some of these experiences, how some of these experiences help people really manage those things. Any other questions?
Well, I'm hoping through the week of these conversations as a nurse midwife to think a little bit about the connections between birth and death.
You know, that's really, that's a great one. Connections between birth and death. This is from another talk, but I'll do it at the end. We talk about advanced healthcare directives and medical directives. And the two groups of people, by overwhelming, the first group of people that ask for medical directives are people who are 65 and older and they're thinking about the end of life. The second biggest group are mothers who give birth. Why is that? Because when you have just given birth, you understand the fragility of life. You know that things could be different and could have been different. You know, so you have that. So it is, there is what connects. The other one, Sarah, between, which we'll talk about more in another talk too, is what? How do you describe death? What is death for you? And that image of what death is, the fear of it, that image will carry a lot of that. Because, of course, there are no experts in death. I mean, where are the experts in death? We don't know where they are. They're having a stress-free existence right now. Okay, so those, any other ones? As we go along, I'm quite sure that there are a number of people in this room who have had either a near-death experience themselves, or they have someone they trust very much who has explained, when I died, or when I almost died, this happened to me. It's a very common thing. We'll get to that just in a minute here. But if you have those experiences, I also want to honor that they are very hard to share with people. Part of the reason they're very hard to share is we tend not to value them in our culture, or we tend to think they're crazy, you know? I mean, and you have television sets and you have this ghost hunters and things like that. I mean, shows like that, they're just total trash kind of things. We tend to see them as crank or crazy kind of thing. So if you have them and you would like to share them, at some point or part of them, I would encourage you, if you feel comfortable and safe to do that, to go ahead and share them in this group. In terms of learning for other people, in terms of hearing just other people value and honor those things too. So if you have those stories along the way, please share them. The ones that I'm going to share with you are come really out of the experiences. I just started hearing so many stories like this. I just started hearing people would start to tell me that these stories and how they affected them. And then I started doing some research and looking into what is the information out there. And there is some information out there. There have been some studies done on what are they like? What do most people, how do the people describe them? And I'll share that kind of stuff. But I want to start with this story. And it's not, classically one of these near-death awareness stories, but it is over a little bit over time. And I said she was... this lady was a classic Lutheran church lady. She was just, Rose was just a wonderful person. I met her the first time as an acute care hospital chaplain. I went in her room and she had a decubitus, a sore on her foot from her diabetes, which she had had before, but this one was bad enough. She's in the hospital. I came in and she was in bed and the Afghan was across the bottom of the bed and she had some flowers in the stand and she had pictures and she offered me coffee. And you wrote, I'll go get some coffee. So we got two cups of coffee and we had coffee, which is, by the way, is against rules, which is not drinking Christian, but I couldn't remember that one. And we had coffee and we had a wonderful conversation about our church, about some of her faith experiences, and we had prayer at the end, and she said, please come back again. And I said, I'd be delighted to. And this relationship happened for about 2 or 3 weeks, but her foot didn't get better this time. This time, the decubitus got worse. They took it on for several surgeries to debride it, to take the dead tissue off. Didn't get any better. And she gradually lost her ability to or desire to interact. I would come in and say, "Good morning, Rose." And she'd say, "Good morning." And I'd say, "You know, Rose, I can see it's kind of hard. You know, I'd be glad to come back later if that's..." No, come in, please sit down. And so I'd come and sit down, and pretty soon I was doing the conversation and she was nodding. And as it went on, she grew less interested so that she would just look at me. But I knew that she wanted me to come in, so because of the history, so I would come in and sit down. Until towards the end, she the only thing she would ask for is, "Would you pray, Pastor?" And then when I would leave, she would say, "Thank you very much." And that's really the piece I knew I should come back again because of that thing. So, and she lost the foot. It was amputated. And she didn't eat very much. She had the antidepressant medications. We're trying to help all these things to keep... She just didn't eat very much. She got weaker. She went to the nursing home, and I visit, because I at the time I was working in the nursing home, I visited her as a chaplain in the nursing home. And as I visited her, it was clear that she was dying. And, you know, I'd go and she hadn't eaten anything. I always checked in with the nurses first. How's it going? Checked in, and one morning, afternoon, I checked in and said, "How's Rose doing?" "Great. She had a good breakfast. She's sitting up in her room." And it was like, what? So I went in her room, and there she was. Back in, back over the end of the bed. She said, "Oh, Pastor, come in. Would you like a cup of coffee?" As if we had moved from one to the other. And I said, I could just put my chair and said, "Rose, this is pretty amazing. I mean, we didn't think you were going to survive, make this." You know, I always stumble when I talk about death. It's one of those things. I said, "Well, what? You got to tell me what happened." She did this. I'm sitting up here. What happened, Rose? And she said, "Well, I saw the face of Jesus." I said, "You did? Tell me what, where did you see, what happened? What, tell me." "Last night," she kind of looked around the room, "last night, right at the end of my bed, I saw the face of Jesus." And me being chaplain, I, you know, said, "Really? What did he look like? Tell me about him." It's like somebody hands you a beautiful rose and you say, "Oh, wow. How did he make it smell?" But she's very gracious, and I figured that out. So I, because this is what she did when I asked her that question, was went from this to... I said, "Rose, that was a beautiful, beautiful... Thank you for sharing with me." "Oh, you're welcome. I said, "Don't worry. You're not crazy. You're not all. It's okay." So she got better. She never got out of the nursing home. She had to sell her house. And I thought, she's going to have to sell her house. Didn't phase her. She died about 6 months later. And it wasn't until sometime after that that I realized, it dawned on me, that when she said, "I saw the face of Jesus," she pointed down over her amputated leg. She pointed on the left side to the end of the bed, right over her where her foot was no longer there. So she had an experience that was not one that you and I, you could just, well, she had a vivid dream. Okay, you could, I mean, that's, but the meaning of what she had was, the experience that she had was not how you describe the vivid dreams. It was something for her that, what did it mean? It meant she was a whole person. She was still Rose, the child of God. She had looked down and she'd seen that truth. And once she saw that truth again, that she wasn't the child of God because she kept her own home and she was very active and a lovely person involved in church and all those good things, then, which she knew all along, of course, then she was at peace. That's that, even though there's an extended period of time, she was still aware of her homeless. But I tell that story because when you hear that story, when you live those, when you've had those kinds of dreams, there's a way in which that's a window into a place that we can't see. Okay? We call them near-death experiences, not death experiences. Okay? If you die, you don't come back to tell us about them. Okay? And frankly, when you get people who said, well, yeah, so-and-so came back and told me about it, da-da-da-da, that's when I'm thinking, oh, okay. There's probably a talk show someplace. Okay? Because, what? Impression?
No, I just, something I'd like you to talk about.
Okay.
No, for the story, you know, people in my family died, and a couple of them got to where Rose was, where they wore out, but they were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
They wore out. Oh my God.
They wore out.
Yeah. They said,
right.
I'm ready to die. My members, I'm completely okay with that. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't give up, but their life just fundamentally changed for a while before they died.
Yeah.
And when you said about Rose, she's dying, you know, that the spirit has, you know, changed. Is that something? I like to talk about that.
Okay.
If that's something that happens and you see and...
Yeah. It is.
And I really am scared that I'm going to be doing this for 2 years where I just don't care. And I'm worn out and I'm just around.
Right.
Is that...
Part of the reason you do that is because you have things to do. And you have, and right now you're at that place where those things make sense. Whatever they are, you got them. We all of us, you don't get to Holden, you don't get in here in this room unless you got things to do, unless you got things that are important and you want to do that. So it doesn't make any sense to us. Actually, that is part of another talk. But I'll share this much is that when you're dying, when you hear that 6 months or less, your world changes. And I don't know exactly what that's like because I haven't had a physician tell me that yet. But it's different. And that difference is where we can't quite walk. We can't quite get there because I don't care. We can all intellectually say, yeah, I know, mortality rate. What is it? Still 100%, right? It's a thought. That's a thought. It's a thought. In our hearts, I still got plans. Yes, I know statistically I could get hit by a car on it. Well, not on that street. I could get hit by a car, right? But that's just words. I'm not really worried about that. I'm not going to change my driving habits. I'm still planning for heart addiction. All those things are going on. You tell me I have pancreatic cancer, and I believe you, my world is different. All of a sudden that, you know. So it's part of what happens sometimes for people is that your world changes so much. All of a sudden, I have different tasks. And once I accomplish those tasks, hey, I'm ready to go. Suitcases are packed. I'm just waiting for the train. You know, I'm ready to go. In fact, sometimes that's actually quite hard for people because they get ready and the train doesn't come on time.
Yeah.
And it gets to be hard for people to do that sometimes.
I think the closest parallel to that, though, is finding out you're going to have a baby. You know, how your life so dramatically changes, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a process. You know, you have a positive pregnancy test, and then you have that process of waiting, and there's always that little bit of fear that, you know, it will not reach fruition. You know, everybody's had losses, you know, but then it keeps ongoing. It's ongoing, and it gets bigger, and there's movement, and you feel things.
And you feel like growing within you.
Exactly. And then the birth comes, and then that's another whole thing. But, you know, there's a lot of parallels, I think, between... You know, hearing that you're dying and knowing that you're going to be parents.
I want to honor that and say my own way. I don't know what you mean because I'm a guy, but I trust you. Did I do well in the end?
You did well.
Maybe. A parallel there in terms of the individuals. We have these transitions that we go through. Transitions matter and they count. And when you're not retired, you don't know what it's like to not be retired. We can make some draw some lines, and there are things in our lives we can draw. But when you know you're dying, when you see the train coming, when Jesus is walking towards Jerusalem, that's my opinion. He doesn't know that he's necessarily that. First, Pilate's going to pick him up and say, toss him over to Herod, and Herod's going to toss him back. He doesn't know that he's going to be a crown of thorns stacked on his head. He doesn't necessarily know that Simon the Cyrenian is going to come down and see the cross. But he sees it coming. He knows he's not getting out of there alive. He reads it. He knows it. He's coming. So his experience of the whole thing is way different than the disciples. They're saying, what do you mean, Jesus? It's looking good to me. Look at these crowds.
Mm-hmm.
relax. What do you mean there's a traitor in the group? Not me. Wouldn't have been. They're just on a totally different page. Jesus keeps trying to teach them, but they can't see it. Because they're not, they got stuff to do. They got it. They got work to do. They got kingdoms to do. But they're Jesus sees it. And that's all he's really can talk about. That's what's in, that's where it's at. Listen, you'll understand later. Right now, just pay attention. Best you can. And so what do? They tell stories about him after he's gone. They start telling stories about him. I remember when. Oh yeah, when we're in that room. Remember when he came to that room? They don't tell the stories until. So, and in a way, that's, you know, when we honor those, these near-death story, near-death experiences and the near-death awareness, and then even extra human experiences, I don't know what the word is, that's so, but those experiences after, there are people who have experiences of their loved ones after they die. Those experiences, what they are, is they are a way, a window into a place we can't be, we can't see. So, and the birth analogy for me is you know, the fetus in the womb has no idea what the sun is or any of those things are. It's just in there, and it's good, and things are going well, and then it's born, and then things change, and there's a whole lot. So it wouldn't make any sense for you to say, okay, fetus in the womb, the sun is out here, and I want you to get ready for it. Right? Because when you're in it, then you see it. So we have that same sense of, there's a connection for us. We have connection, but our vision is clouded by the womb, by the shell, and as it should be, and as it is. That's kind of crazy. So I want you to know that I have a bit of ADHD, and so that I wrote all these things down in this handout. I hope we get to them. If you have, again, if you have, we'll try specific questions. But I did want to go over a little bit the some of the descriptions. So because they're kind of helpful. The stories, these are stories of our modern day journey right to the edge of things. The first one is looking over our near death experiences. I got back up half step here, folks, because I did. This in terms of that we were just talking about being there but not being there, and that skepticism we hold. This is from Alice Walker. I love this quote. This is the true line of astonishment. We are not over when we think we are. That glimpse into what it is. And in terms of telling those stories to people, a gentleman, Ray Breen, he was he and his brother made a lot of money in Bemidji selling clothing. Really good guys, supported their Catholic church. Very, you know, and I had the privilege of visiting him as he's coming out of his life in the nursing home. And one day he slipped me a greeting card from the 1930s. He said, I wanted you to have this. I said, thank you, Ray. And I looked at it and read it in another room, and then I read the verse, and this is what the verse said. When the golden sun is sinking, when your mind from pleasure free, when of others you are thinking, will you sometimes think of me? Mm-hmm. So I said, yes, Ray, I will. I promised him. So, again, thinking of that story, to sharing those things, that's helpful. So the stories, near-death experiences, they're a modern, fairly modern phenomenon. We didn't have them before. We didn't have them before we had World War II and Korea and MASH units, and we figured out how to keep people alive when they got closer to the edge. And we're getting better and better at it. You get closer and closer to that edge, and we can pull you back from that edge. So in some ways, they're fairly not new experience. Other ways, they've been around a long time. I mean, if you're just doing Bible study on Jonah, right? Well, 3 days in the belly of that fish, you don't get any closer to the edge than that. And his prayer, if you're reading Jonah, his prayer is not different than a near-death experience. Right? All of a sudden, things change for him. So those stories, but the near-death experiences, they often come, and they often come from, they're the result of what we do so well, of saving lives. We've saved those lives, and we bring things back. In the 1970s and 80s, this phenomenon really got more and more stories were told. And then there was a book, you might remember, it was a picture of woman was, I couldn't find a copy, but A Light Coming Down. It was called Life After Life. Raymond Moody wrote it in 1975. It was a very popular book that really described these kinds of experiences. And what he did is he put them into some categories. Well, there have been a number of studies that have been done since that haven't been, some of them have been published. But this is probably the currently the most, her name is Janice Amatuzio. She is a forensic pathologist in Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. It's called Forever Hours. And it is stories that she has had of experiences where, as a medical examiner, she has gone to tell people about why and how their loved one died. And then they share with her stories they've experienced. And I've heard her speak. She is very good, very just a scientist all the way through. So she has a kind of credibility when she talks about these things. So that's a really good book that talks about some of them. So, and what they, in some of these studies, and I don't know, it's hard to imagine how they get these diseases, but they say about 1 in 3 people who come close to the end of their life like that, hearts started again, things like that, have these kinds of experiences. About 40% of the people who are resuscitated with the path of electricity, about 40% of those people describe these kinds of experiences. The interesting thing is that sometimes these experiences, they describe experiences and they have memories of experiences at times when we understand that the brain is not making memories. The brain is not a place where it can store memories, where it creates. When you make memories, there's electrical activity in your brain, and there's all kinds of processes that go on biochemically. You have to have a certain amount of oxygen, you have to have a certain amount of stimulus. Those things have to be there for you to make a memory. What happens if your heart stops and you get low blood oxygen, besides everybody saying, it's going to be brain damage, it's going to be brain damage, what happens is your ability to make memories is gone. You can't make memories, and you don't have the stuff that needs to make them. You don't have the electricity, you don't have the oxygen, so we've got to get that back into you as fast as we can in order for you to bring it back. At the same time, people will describe things like, I heard you say, doctor, that we're losing him, or things. And the doctor will go, who told you that? Or they'll say, my wife was sitting right outside that door. Well, how would, and she was. Okay? So they have experience, and when people come out of these things, they're always groggy. If you have this kind of experience, you come out, you're confused, you don't know what's happened, and there's a process of waking up. In that process of waking up, of course, they've done brain scans, monitoring. They monitor that process. People have memories then. So how does that happen? Well, that's a bit of the uncertain. In our culture, in our time, we are connected to the science in a way that science tends to tell us what truth is or not, and what we can connect or not. And it's very difficult to understand how those processes happen. And that's for other folks to really deal with it. But there's room there. We have associated the mind with biochemical processes. And in a way, this suggests that the mind may be, the experience of life may be more, less dichotomous than we usually talk about it. Less this or that, more integrated. And you got here, my sense that these are powerful stories don't come from scientific information, they come from the lived experience of people, having heard these stories and how they use them in their lives.
The neuroscientists are still not really good at consciousness and where that comes from and all that.
They really aren't, yeah. It's very hard because it is such an amazingly complex process. It is so complex. We are, because we have the illusion, we break things apart, and so we have the illusion that there's something called mind, body, and spirit. That's just our made up idea. You can't separate me from my mind and my body and me. They are all together. They are one thing. If you challenge If you crack my spirit and destroy it, you will follow. But what does that mean exactly? Well, you know, there are certain descriptions, things could happen to me that would do that to me. I know I would become a vegetable. I wouldn't function. I would quit. I would want to escape totally. Other things, you know, but on the other hand, you cut off my arm, and that's not my arm. It's not me. I mean, that's my arm, but I'm still me, and I can still be me, right? But we're integrated. And that's, to me, that's the beauty of things. They talk about the integration. If you hear these stories, you have to hear about the integration.
How many of these stories are cross-cultural?
Yeah, actually...
A Maasai near-death experience versus a Aboriginal, not just a bunch of people in America from different cultures.
No, right.
Truly extra cultural from our experience, because we have certain... You know, when you read these stories often, I haven't read a lot of stories you read, tend to be integrated within our culture.
Right, and that's because we bring the most people back, partly.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
We have the most information, I mean, these kinds of specific stories. But some of those studies, some people have tried to look at cross cultures, and there is a cross cultural piece to this. And it happens, I know about it myself this way, because in Bemidji, it wasn't the face of Jesus that this gentleman saw. It was, can you remember the name of God? Gichi Mantu, which is
okay.
The name for God.
Right.
And he saw the trail and his mocks. He saw what he saw. So he saw something different. It tends to be that when you see things that you can identify, they tend to be culturally and individually specific, some aren't. Right? Those kinds of things. Well, how can that? But there are similarities, okay? And I think I've got them actually written down there for you. Let's see.
Are there negative ones too?
They're actually about 10% of them, but they people hesitate to talk about the positive ones. They hesitate even more when they're talking about the negative ones. But there are negative experiences that people have. They are most often associated with traumatic events, really traumatic events. And they are most often, they are ones that people, it's hard for them to describe them. They don't want to think about them for a while. They do describe them in times and they can work, but that does happen. The majority of them that we know about, people describe the positive ones. But you got to test the spirits. And that fundamental question is, you have to test the spirits. If you hear a story like this, I need to test the spirits. What is it? What is the story? And the key question for that is, the key question that I ask is, so how have these stories that you've had, how have they affected your life? What do they mean to you? What do they mean to you? If you're terrified, then you need to think about them in a different kind of way. Do they give you a sense of peace? Who are they? To test them and ask those kinds of questions. But these stories, they tend to be about the same, and there's some component. How do they describe? They tend to be religious or spiritual descriptions of things. They tend to see specific images, or those that they identify with spiritual images. You want to, yeah? Could you open that door? Just slide it open. I think we need it. There's a lot of warm air moving around here. Sorry about that. They tend to be hard for people to describe. You know, when you want detail, it's hard to give detail. But it isn't hard to say what they are in kind of larger context. They tend to be sensory experiences. For near-death experiences now, they tend to be sensory. That is, they describe sensation. They can tell you what it felt like to be dead. They can tell you what it felt like to leave my body. They can tell you how I didn't have pain anymore. They can tell you about a tunnel experience, although that is not as consistent as you would think. That particular tunnel experience, that's one that Moody described, and it shows up, but statistically, it doesn't show up. It's not one of those things that, you know, I can tell you the things that it's sensory, it tends to be related, those things for sure. Tunnel experience, some people have that, some people don't. Okay. Descriptions of light are very, very common. Descriptions of a sense of euphoria are very common. Of having others there, whether I've seen them or I don't see them, but I know they're there, is are very, very common. Those kinds of things happen. So I tell you, a story. I met this man when he was suffering from, he had just been diagnosed with mesothelioma, which is a cancer of the lung, surrounding the lungs, that comes from asbestos. He was an electrical engineer, a very good one. In fact, he worked on a lot of big projects, and he was really a person who went in and did the inspecting work. And he told me a story about the time when he was just gotten married for the second time, and he opened up the electrical panel, and when he did, the oxygen hit it, and the thing exploded, and it blew him back across until he hit a solid wall and dented it, kind of thing. Burned him over 82% of his body. Wasn't whether he would live or not. Had a number of surgeries, was getting a little better, but these were very painful surgery, and they didn't do the anesthesia following the surgeries. So he was in the midst of, they were in the midst of grafting him. He had enough pain on medication on board so he couldn't respond or speak, but not enough to be unconscious. So they were starting this procedure in intense pain, and suddenly he's done. And he has experience of leaving his body. He also has experience of seeing the hospital staff start to scramble. His respiration's going down, da-da-da. They started it, he wasn't responding. He had the experience of moving up and away from that and turning to find a door that was open that he could go through, right? And it was good. And he thought it would be a good idea maybe to, it wouldn't be so bad. It's a lot cooler out there. He was moving towards that door, okay? And then he realized that he had just gotten married a few years before, and he had made a commitment to his wife, whom he told me later he didn't really love her that much when he married her, but she had a couple kids. He had a couple kids. They couldn't make it on their own. They kind of liked each other, and they decided they would help raise each other's kids. And by the time he's telling me this now, 25 years later, they were very much in love. But they he realized he had made that commitment, and so he had to turn physically and look back and decide to go back. And then he knew if he took that next step, he would have to go back into that pain. Because he wasn't in pain. And he had to decide what kind of person he was, what he was going to do. Now, there wasn't a sense of God out there. There wasn't a sense for him. And at that point, he didn't talk about, but he talked about what he needed to do. And he decided to go back into that pain. Right? And by the way, the physicians did hear about the pain medication issue. Because he survived. He had the operations, he got better. And ironically, the asbestos that he looked in did end up taking his life. But he had to come back into it. Now, that I tell that story because it is, of the stories I've heard, near-death experiences, as when people come close to that end, many times the story is about my life and who I am and what kind of a person I am, or I will be, or I could be. When people come back from those experiences, they often have a sense of some kind of purpose or mission. There's a reason they're there. And that's actually where some of the negative stuff comes back. Not that the experience was negative, it was good, but I got pulled back. And I don't want to be here. Who I wanted to go there. We resuscitated somebody who was wanting to leave. And so, what do I do now? How do I live my life now? And I was just mad. Because it was really good there, and this is crappy. Because my health is still bad, everything is still bad, it's still bad, and now I'm back. Right?
That's suicidal people that are brought back. Okay.
I don't know the statistics on that, but my own personal experience, the one that I know of personally, and I think I wish I could say I really know where I read this. It often does give people a sense that they have a second chance. And for people who are thinking about taking their own lives, sometimes when you have that sense that I have a second chance, then they do make a change. The one I'm thinking of, it was very much a part of, I have a second chance, God has given me a second chance, and now I need to live my life differently than I was living. But it's not for, there's no uniformity, it doesn't one size fit all, these kinds of things. But people oftentimes have a sense of a destiny, a mission, a reason why they're back. Sometimes it's to tell people about God. I had one woman who told me about her experience. She was I'm a Lutheran pastor all the way through, and this was a lady who came in, and she had a debilitating syndrome of immunity deficiencies, and I wish I could remember the name of the disease, but her body was just slowly not being able to function anymore. It couldn't keep any slowly in different ways, couldn't fight infections, couldn't, and so she was slowly dying very slowly over time. And she told me about her near-death experience, which happened several years before when she was in the hospital in Ohio, and she went into an operating room. And she described it this way. She said, I was there, and the Lord took me back to the beginning of time. And at the beginning of time, the Lord showed me the world. And the world was without any form. And she went through and she described how the Lord took her through the centuries and the creation of life, and how that life evolved and got bigger and diverse. And the message for her was, well, God's taking care of this thing. God will take care of this thing. I mean, look, God took care of it from the beginning through here. And I'm right here. God's going to take care of it from here on. Right? She just, the whole evolutionary thing was a little, didn't quite fit into her faith framework. But that was okay because, you know, God showed her that, so it was okay. They didn't have, and I thought that was just such a delight that then, you know, I just had to ask her. I knew her well enough to ask her that. She just, well, I don't know why are you asking me that? It's a dumb question. It doesn't matter. And I said, okay. So then what she feared was being in the hospital. She feared what we could do to her while she was in the hospital. And yet, of course, she wasn't ready to die, so she would come into the hospital. You know, it's a very legitimate, I mean, and yeah, go ahead. If you need to go, feel free. That's all right. Don't worry about it. You bet. But she wasn't afraid about death and dying. So when she got to the point where she could go into the hospice program and go home and not have to worry about going back into the hospital, then her life, the fear and the anxiety that really debilitated her even more and got in the hospital faster went away, and she got better for a while because she wasn't worried about what would happen. So, and then she died a fairly peaceful death, not because of the illness process, it wasn't painless, but it was, she was at peace with the journey she sent. Now those are near death, and I actually was planning to spend more time on the near death experiences because they're really so vivid in describing how people experience things. But near-death awareness is way more common. It's a very common experience. Near-death awareness is that that sense that that you're just right there. You're moving into that process. It most often happens with people who have progressive debilitating illnesses. If you've been around people who are dying, they have that. If you're looking at them, and they'll look right past you. Now I'm so nearsighted, I can look right past everybody. But it's that sense that you know they're not seeing you, right? And you move in the way, and they're looking right through. Okay. Near-death experiences. People quite often describe, tell you somebody's waiting for them. They're often very relational. Near-death experiences, excuse me, are. But they don't always describe people there. They're often about how I'm going to live and who am I as a person. Near-death awareness very often are mostly relational. Dad is waiting for me. Yeah, but Dad's been dead for 20 years. He's right there in the corner. Those kinds of things. Very common. Very common experiences. I want you to know, if somebody said that to you, very, very common experiences. I'd say they happen more often than they don't happen in these kinds of situations. That those kinds of things. And you have to make a distinction between delirium and near-death awareness. Delirium is that terrible process of being so confused because your body chemistry is so out of whack that it's, it can be quite terrifying for people. Again, it's testing the spirits. If I see my uncle standing there, my favorite uncle standing there, and that doesn't create anxiety, there's no need to talk me out of it. There's no need to get medication to help me so I go to sleep and I won't have a bad dream, right? So, and those kinds of experiences people have, those near-death awareness, oftentimes, they're very, very reassuring to people. And if they aren't reassuring people, there's often a task that needs to get done. There's often a reason why. And if there's enough time and space in that dying process to be aware to ask what that reason, what we need to do, there's often a way in which you can do that thing. Even if it isn't exactly what they want. I have to make up with my brother. Well, he's in Kansas and we can't get him here. Okay, what can we, what does that mean? There's often a way to help that process. But most of them are, and what they are is they're preparation for dying. They're, whereas the near-death experiences are often preparation for living your life, these are preparations for dying. Okay? And people ask these questions. If you hear somebody telling my stories, these are often the questions they're asking. Have I lived a life worth living? Have I learned something? Have I contributed to the world around me? If you know them, oftentimes it's a matter of affirming them. Yes, you certainly have. I'm sitting here on one. I love you. Isn't that a contribution to you? They review their lives oftentimes. They'll talk about the first time, something for the first time that they haven't talked about before. Sometimes you'll be surprised at what you'll find out. People in these experiences oftentimes will get that far away process and you'll think they've almost died, and then they'll come back. And then they'll talk about some of these things. Sometimes they won't talk about it at all, but they have a sense of peace. Somebody says, you know, Dad was so afraid of dying, he was just afraid of dying, and then, but he's at peace. It's like, what happened? Well, from my perspective, this process was honored, and in some ways that process came about. They're always, always relationally centered. They're about love. Who's loved me? How do I love them? And they're often themes that they have. If you hear them, themes. One of the things that I've learned over 15 years, absolutely true, the dying and those who love them will tell you absolutely everything you need to know. Absolutely everything. If you're listening, if you can hear them. Sometimes you can't hear them. And that's hard. Sometimes we just can't hear what they have to say, but they will tell you almost everything you need to know. In another session, we'll talk about some of those personal things. But this is a story of this woman is in a rehab. She was in a physical rehab unit, and I'm smiling because she was just a dear lady. And they asked the chaplain to go see her, talk to her. How come? Well, she's not doing the exercises. She could, but she's not doing them, and we can't get her to do them. And she's such a nice lady. We tried everything, and we can't really threaten her like we do some old crush old man. So we'll send the chaplain. Edith, how you doing? You know why they sent me in here? Because you're not doing your exercises, and they think I can make you do them. So we started talking, right? And she told me that the reason she's not doing the exercises is because she doesn't need to. Well, you want to get home, don't you? Well, that'd be okay, but I don't really need to. Well, because I only have to stay alive for 2 more years. Why is that? Because right now, with my Social Security, I'm putting my granddaughter through college. And she graduates in 2 years. And that, so I don't really need to do these exercises. Okay, I can understand that. So let's compromise. You do a little bit of exercise enough so you can stay in the program. We can visit the house. But then she said, but I want to tell you something. Okay? Yeah. And so I visited her, and she said, I got to tell you about my husband. And he died about 4 years before, and he had a stroke on his left side. And so for about 3 years, his left side was completely flaccid. And she'd take care of him at home for most of that time, and she'd done a very good job of taking care of him at home. She was not a trained therapist or trained nurse. So he had some significant limits that were there, but she'd take care of him. But he was coming in his life. His cardiac problems got worse. He was dying. They called him. five kids. She had six. They called. All six of them, five came, talked to him. They had said their goodbyes. He was barely conscious a little bit, and he was slipped into unconsciousness. And Ted wasn't home yet. He's, of course, the son who lives in Alaska, right? So it took him longer to get there. He comes walking into the door. Dad had not been responsive for a day and a half, 2 days. He comes walking into the door and says, taking his coat off as he walks, says, "Dad, I'm here." His dad says, "Ted, I'm so glad you could make it." He walks over to his son, leans over, and Ted's dad puts both arms around him and hugs him,
mm-hmm.
and then lays back and dies in a few minutes. Right? That was the story she needed to tell me about. His journey, but that is what I would call a near-death awareness. Ted's father knew he was dying, and he also had something in his life that he needed to stay alive for, and he was doing his best to do that. Okay, so he conserved his energy. He used as little as possible. Of course, this isn't. I'm talking as if it's a conscious, rational thing. It's not at all. Of course, it's a lived spiritual reality truth. I regret we don't have time. There's a number of biblical images that fit with it. But he was able to do that. And was Ted came when he needed to come. Now, you all have people that died in your life. How many of them waited till the wedding? Huh? How many of them waited till the graduation? Waited till this? I did that. In fact, there were some people in the hospital, they set that goal to get there, and then they set the next goal and they get there. They set the next goal. You know? But that's a little different. But again, that's near-death awareness. That is having a clarity about what needs to be happening. When you're not there, we're just not that clear. That's one of the reasons you all are interested in these stories, and one of the reasons I go back to them. That's one of the reasons. We had just showed the tape, a CD of the gentleman who gave that last lecture, the brilliant engineer, who had pancreatic cancer. Okay? Mm-hmm. That was a really powerful story. I'm wondering which one that is. Oh, okay. We showed that and he kind of has his sense of clarity about what needs to happen and where things are going. And
Randy Pouch.
What's that thing?
Mm-hmm. Pouch.
Yeah. Randy Pouch.
We'll show it again later this week.
But I tell you, we walked out of there, everyone focused on it. Why? Because the man is dying, and he knows it. And he's in a place we aren't quite in, and we want to learn and we want to listen. Because what he has to say is important. Okay, that's part of what near-death awareness is it's not just the person who's dying, it's for us who love them. I think that's part of what happened. It's for us to love them. It changes the way we do things. You know, it changes the way we do, the way we approach things too, because Dad was at peace. I tell you, that gal, I'm quite sure Esther, I think it was, wouldn't have survived as long as she did to get her granddaughter through college if she hadn't had a sense that her husband was at peace when he died. And we knew everybody. I tell that story, you know he's at peace, right? It doesn't matter what happened the rest of his life. He came to a place of peace because of the story. Way he tells the story. So the stories for near-death awareness are for the person who's dying to prepare, but it's for them to prepare us for the dying. I only got 5 minutes left, and I want to break through the last one too, because those experiences, and I've had much fewer of these told to me, and I haven't been able to find as much information about them that makes sense, that I can kind of trust. But it's that experience of... One I remember vividly as a young woman who was, her father was, her grandmother was dying, and her family decided that it was too traumatic for her to stay there, so they sent her home. And this was, she was telling me, she was approximately my age, and she was telling me she was about 15 or 10, 12, somewhere right in there when this happened. She went home, and she, of course, when she got home, was thinking of her grandma, so she did what her grandma would have done, and she started washing the floor. I know it's 10 o'clock at night, but she was washing the floor, cleaning up, you know, all alone. And her grandmother passed away in the hospital, and her mom called her and said, "Grandma died." And she said, "Yeah, I know." "Well, how do you know?" "Because she was here." she was. Yeah, at 5 after 10. That's when I died. Those kinds of experiences. Now, that was a vivid, you know, vividly. There are many others people have of, I was in bed and I felt her, you know, leaning up against me. I saw him in the door. There's lots of different ways people explain those things. This one, I hesitate using it as an example because I couldn't make it on TV. This good friend of mine was a very eccentric guy, very big heart, helped a lot of people, couldn't help himself, ended up taking his own life, shot himself. Just really sad that didn't happen that way. For a year afterwards, he'd been watching a particularly horrifying show, a Nazi. He was a history buff kind of thing, something on History Channel, and had been drinking too much. But for a year later, the television set would turn on every Thursday afternoon when his wife was home. Okay? Freaked her out at first, got the television fixed, turned on. So she let it be. Okay? She turned it on after a little bit. It changed from something she was, that was like, to, oh, you know, to, is it going to turn on?
He's here again.
Yeah, he's here again. After a year, it stopped. Okay? Message for her was, he's okay. Mm-hmm. He's okay. It may have taken him a year, but he's okay. Mm-hmm. Now, this person, my friends, are not connected to a particular faith community. Their spirituality tends to be eclectic, being a lot of things. But her sense was, he is at peace. That was the message. And those kinds of those extra experiences, they are for the person who died. I mean, who's alive. So you have the first ones are more for the people themselves. The second group tends to be for both, prepare for that. And the last one tends to be for the people who are left behind, for them to have a sense of peace. And overwhelmingly, the ones as far as I've heard, what little I found, is that's the message. The message is, I'm okay. And that's, you know, this is what you really hear a lot of in this book. The boss left on, the things that you know, can be described as, well, that's pretty explaining. And it may be. The question is, how does it affect you? What does it mean? What does it mean? So we get back into these experiences in our faith context. The meaning of them is, who are we? What do they mean? How do they shape our lives? How is it that I love someone so much that they will touch me again and continue to shape my life? Thank you for coming. We're at the end. I'd be glad to answer questions. Anything. If you feel like you need to leave, go get ready for worship praying. Please feel free to do that. Okay. If you have any questions, go ahead. Anyone else?